Right now, though, it is a pleasure to welcome in David Tarachuk. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. David is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. And we're lucky enough to have him join us here on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. Good to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and joining a whole new and hearty Marshall Miles, huh? Thankfully freed from quarantine now. How are you doing, Marshall?
Okay, it turned out I did not test positive for COVID, and I did not test positive for the flu, but they did find through blood tests some examples of what might be affecting me, and we've been trying to trace this down with my doctor for about a year and a half now, and it looks like at the end of the month we're going to take some more tests, and it looks like we're going to have a prognosis to move forward, but I feel fit as a fiddle now, back at work. And you know, David, I never miss work, and to miss 3 or 4 days.
I know that. You never miss. And you've got an attendance record even better than mine. I understand I've missed about 6 Fridays in all the many years I've been doing the show, but you have hardly lost any, right?
Just these 3 days and a couple of years ago when I had surgery. But other than that, my doctor said I apologized to him, and he said for this, and he said, Marshall, don't apologize. Your problem is you never tell me when you're sick.
you're a modern medical miracle. So, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, first thing I want to talk about...
There's a lot, right?
It's not important, but it is important, and that is what's going on with Dvojtchik and Australia, and how he lied on his... the thing that I think he did wrong is he lied on his application when he came in, and now it's turned, once again, something that's not political has turned into a huge political discussion.
Sure. Ideology and the great argument, I guess, of the moment is, you know, personal rights versus communal rights, if you like, or communal responsibility. I think COVID has brought that that very broad issue into a very sharp focus in many parts of the world, and the argument over Djokovic in Australia is one example of that. It's another instance, I guess, of an individual thinking he can work to his own rules, and a state rather cumbersomely and awkwardly, Australia and its individual states are not always, you know, the federal level and the state level are not always in perfect sync with each other, and that's been demonstrated in this case too. but the overall argument is over whether an individual can claim an exemption, and the ways that he tried to claim an exemption from a general rule is what's at the heart of this issue now. Two times over now, he's had his visa revoked because he wasn't. It appears he wasn't wholly honest in his application for exemption, and now we're. It's kind of up in the air again, but the tilt is very clear. The ground is tilting very hard against Djokovic in this argument.
It's just one of those things that it seems like that doesn't matter what country you're in today, sooner or later everything turns into politics and turns into a big brouhaha. Well, let's move to Washington, where the mess continues once again. And the mess is on both sides, actually. You've got the CDC, the FDA, all these different issuances of things. Then you've got Joe Biden, who I think is doing something smart. He's going to try to centralize the 2022 election on voting rights. He doesn't have a chance in the world of blowing up the nuclear option right now in the Senate, but he's going to try to use that as a focal point in the race to take over the Senate and to keep the House in 2022, and that has just created a lot of, once again, strange going-ons in Washington, D.C.
Sure, and by striking out the way that both the president and the vice president did today, this week on that issue, it shows that the fight has to be in more than just Washington. Georgia was the focus for the administration's push, a belated push in many progressive critics' view, I suppose, for stronger voter rights legislation at the federal level. It was interesting to see. NPR make a special coverage day of it when President Biden and Vice President Harris went to speak in Atlanta, NPR combining with Georgia Public Broadcasting for the event. Georgia is an important state for this overall struggle at federal level, of course. It went narrowly for Biden in the 2020 presidential election, and of course the Republican official in charge of voting there, the state secretary of state, came under pressure from then still President Trump to find those extra votes for him, for Trump, in that infamous phone call. Georgia voted in two Democratic senators in the U.S. Senate in that special runoff, and significantly, Georgia, of course, is the home state of Stacey Abrams, the tireless voting rights campaigner who's now running for governor in the state. It was really intriguing that she was notable for her absence when that big administration push was made in Atlanta. Just a scheduling problem, we were told, a little incredulously perhaps. As I said, some people think it's a little too late, too late pushing by the White House here.
Taking a look at we'll keep it in a mess in Washington, D.C., the Justice Department announced the first sedition charges. Now, this is a big step. Sedition charges are different than the charges they have filed so far in the January 6th attack on the Capitol, leveled against the far-right extremist group called the Oath Keepers. Sedition charges
are a totally different
charge and much, much more serious.
Yeah, notable and serious ramping up in the federal criminal cases overall. There's 700 cases so far relating to the January 6th, 21 invasion of the Capitol. Indictments unsealed yesterday for a seditious conspiracy. Very important new level reached in the in the charges being laid. And although some of the people being indicted, I think 10 people in all, have already been indicted on other charges, but two people were new, and one of them, arrested yesterday in Texas, is Stuart Rhodes, founder and leader of that extremist group, the Oath Keepers. He's been mentioned in the course of these investigations many times over, and there's been speculation that his training as both a U.S. Army paratrooper and then as a Yale Law School graduate, plus especially his taking good care, it seems, not to actually enter the Capitol building on January the 6th himself. He was on the Capitol grounds, but he didn't enter any of the buildings. The feeling was that would keep him from prosecution, but not so. There's many stemwinder, ruminative headlines like, is he a paramilitary commander or a couch surfing grifter? Well, those headlines seem to be things of the past now. He's indicted on seditious conspiracy charges, and as you say, that's a new level of seriousness. If convicted, he stands to spend 20 years in prison, and we're going to see more of his notable photograph and the videos in which he appears. Stuart Rogers, complete with his possibly dashing, possibly sinister, I can't tell, that black, very distinctive black eye patch of his.
It's hard to believe it's been well over a year since that. Interesting. What are your thoughts? This is always in the back of my mind. Nobody talks about this. There are a lot of statewide investigations into Donald Trump. When these all go to court, and they're on so many different things over the course of the next year, is this having the possible effect that Donald Trump finally is coming out and attacking leading members of his party, like Governor DeSantis and other people? He's breaking the ties where he's trying to set up an advance. He can keep control of the Republican Party.
Well, this fight for the Republican Party, the soul of the party, if the Republican Party can be said to have a soul, and that's a whole separate argument, this is going to be the issue, I think, the election-related issue of this year. There are prominent Republicans, members of the U.S. Senate, speaking out this last week against Trump and against the Trump lie that he had the election stolen from him. It's really interesting how that argument has become so so central to the run up to the midterms in November of this year. We'll see it becoming more and more to the fore and becoming more and more crucial to whether or not Trump is the de facto leader of the Republican Party, which he has obviously assumed that he is, or if he's not, and whether the Republicans who are speaking out against him now are just a quick flash in the pan, or whether there's going to be a real effort by the elders, if you like, of the Republican Party, and those with a more realistic, if I can be slightly party pree here, a more realistic sense of what American politics actually enable you to do. It doesn't seem likely, I don't think, in the long run, that we're going to have a Trump running, and we'll have this figure of Donald Trump in place to take the nomination for the 2024 election. But I could be wrong, and what could be happening is that this argument will be lost by the elders who are trying to reassert realism amongst Republicans. First of all, at the official level, and eventually they hope to get the ground level supporters on their side. At the moment, you know, we have this remarkable phenomenon that 70%+ of Republicans believe that Trump is right and the election was stolen from him. But I think in media terms, it might be worth remembering that my slip just now about watching or seeing what was happening in the voting rights argument in Georgia earlier this week is actually indicative, really, what's been going on this week, with the most notable media appearance by Trump himself. Very unusually, he appeared on NPR to have an interview with Steve Inskeep. Now, NPR has been trying to get an interview with Trump for 5 years now, and finally he came on the air. I think the best way of marking it is to quote Andy Borowitz, our local hero in Robin Hood Land. He riffed on NPR's striking interview with Trump about Trump's own lies in a very pointed way. Borowitz's satire had Trump complaining about the interviewer, Steve Inskeep. You remember that Inskeep kept on, very reasonably, fact-checking the ex-president until Trump, in total exasperation, hung up on him only 9 minutes into what was scheduled as a 15-minute phone call. Let me quote the Borowitz report exactly, although, you know, because of the tone of political satire these days, you always have to underline the fact that this is satire, this is not a real report, but it's so telling in its overall satirical truthness, if I can put it that way. I'll quote the Borowitz report. After abruptly hanging up on one of its hosts, Donald J. Trump called NPR the worst TV network in America. Trump said that the host, Steve Inskeep, was, quote, a loser like you wouldn't believe, who never should have been given a television show. He's one of the reasons nobody watches NPR.
You know, because we're an NPR station, we were notified in advance of that interview, and all I said to myself was, okay, I know that they're trying to be fair and balanced. I know that they're trying to do what they need to do, but this is just not going to go well. There's no way it's going to go well at all. And
no, it did not go well. But it challenged NPR to do something with it, and it was an interesting, you know, as a professional, you know, as a matter of professional practice, it was interesting how they then edited that tape gave it lots of context, explained exactly what Trump was trying to do, or what his references meant. Because interviewing Trump is always difficult. He assumes that you know what's in his head already and what argument he's been pursuing, and which names he drops, who he actually means, and why this individual needs to be singled out. It all requires contextualizing, if I can give it that grand title. But making sense of Trump in an interview is a difficult job sometimes. But the job done by Morning Edition and Steve Inskeep himself was very healthy response to being hung up on, I think. And it shows exactly what Trump is attempting to do in this broad struggle we were just talking about for the soul of the Republican Party.
You know, and it's interesting, Steve Inskeep did a great job, simply because when you are a co-host, an interviewer on Morning Edition, and you're allotted 15 minutes, and I think they handled the shortness of it really, 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 really well and really professional. And also Inskeep himself is a very calm questioner, doesn't raise his voice, doesn't get confrontational, just asks the questions. I think you're right. He did a very, very, very good job in a tough situation live on one of NPR's biggest shows.
Well, it wasn't live, but they treated it as a live piece, certainly, in the par when they were talking directly with the ex-president. And yes, you're right. I mean, it was all a matter of being very calm and responding to what the network itself and most professional journalists now are perfectly at home with calling Trump's lies. Inskeep called them out one by one in the course of Trump expressing them. And I suppose it's no surprise that the bad-tempered Trump would eventually hang up and just disappear.
Well, it's we're going to switch from Donald Trump to two big body blows to rich and famous people. First of all, Ghislaine Maxwell last week. Obviously, she's going to try to save her skin by talking. But now what's happened with Prince Andrew on the other side of the ocean. Let's talk a little bit about Prince Andrew, because this is also pretty drastic stuff from the Queen.
Yeah, American colleagues often ask me, as originally a British journalist covering the world, though now I'm a naturalized U.S. citizen, I'm asked about my views on the British royal news. I have to confess I have no great interest in them, the royals. I certainly don't have the palace connections, usually comprising backstairs leaks, effectively, that seem necessary to report on that strange world. But now you're right. Real world developments of a serious nature have intruded on the closed world of the royal family and their entourage. So I guess it's one of those occasions when we do have to talk about them. The apex of it all this week, of course, has been, as always, the Queen herself. And when she actually gets down to doing something in real terms, then you've got real news. Queen Elizabeth is now publicly, and with the formality and finality that she's capable of, I guess, she has stripped her son, Prince Andrew, of all his official royal offices, those that are rather traditional for the adult members of the family. Things like the only nominal leadership of British Army regiments, that sort of thing, and also the other kind of nominal royal stamp that he, like other royals, has been involved in, providing his name on the letterhead of British charities, for instance. It's called patronage, the royal patronage. I somehow don't think that those charities will particularly miss him. Many of them dropped his name some time ago. And the word coming out of military barracks, too, is that, for instance, one regiment that I am in touch with, the Grenadier Guards in London, certainly haven't wanted him for some time as their nominal colonel-in-chief, as he's called. And perhaps the most pointed of all has been that the remarkable letter from veterans drawn from across all of the UK's armed services addressed to the Queen personally. It's a remarkable letter acknowledging that. Let me quote from it. We understand that, Your Majesty, they say, we understand that he is your son. But they don't say, if this is a very pointed quote, too, any other senior, if this were any other senior military officer, it is inconceivable that he would still be in post. Well, that's a very interesting crunch point that we've reached with the royal family. And in this case, Amanda, it's all, of course, been prompted here in New York by Virginia Giuffre being allowed by a New York judge, Lewis Kaplan, to press her civil case against the prince. And the judge, in doing so, rejected Andrew's effort to have the case thrown out. And her case is, of course, that the infamous and now deceased child abuser Jeffrey Epstein trafficked Virginia Giuffre when she was only 17 to have sex with the prince in the U.S., in the U.K., and in the Caribbean. Now, we know this judge very well here in New York. Judge Kaplan is notable perhaps more than anything else for his judgments against the infamous Gambino crime family on charges, interestingly, ranging from racketeering to underage sexual trafficking. You know, since the Andrew case first came into public view a few years ago, this sex case, the prince has perhaps wisely been reducing his public profile anyway, now coming to nearly zero, except for his one complete train wreck of a TV interview. You'll remember it, I'm sure, with the BBC. That merely served to damage his reputation even more. But yesterday's new and formal official steps taken by the Queen seem to mark the complete nadir of his public life. I mean, there is, of course, still the actual hearing of the case in full ahead of us. I mean, unless Andrew's lawyers appeal successfully against this judgment this week, or unless, of course, a settlement is reached between the two sides out of court. But if things do go ahead, even amid the logjam of cases in New York courtrooms caused by COVID, the civil trial could still happen before long. We should note, absolutely, that Andrew denies all these charges. And that, you know, we should note also that he'll be defending himself as a private individual now, using his own personal funds. And that means he possibly has to raise those funds by selling his substantial Swiss property in the skiing resort of Verbier.
And one final thing before we go, and that is what has come over the light the past couple of weeks about what happened at the two staff parties, number 10, before Prince's Philip's funeral. His own party really attacked Bojo, Boris Johnson, and Boris Johnson's apologized not only to them but also to the Queen. That is just another unusual situation and a misstep once in the political arena for Bojo, even though he wasn't at the parties, but it happened under his watch.
They happened under his watch, and yes, he seems to think that because they were in the open air, in the rather beautiful walled garden of number 10 Downing Street, that they weren't a danger to public health. And he also seemed to think, he tried to imply in his rather measly sort of apology that he was giving in the House of Commons, that it was not a party exactly, it was a work event. The garden was being used as a workspace, but you know, the message that went out to staff, including the initials, or the concept conveyed by the initials of BYOB, bring your own booze, suggested that well, I'm not sure that could ever possibly be described as a work event. No, they were partying in the middle of very strict COVID restrictions, and they were doing it on the eve of, in one case, and in the eve of the Queen's husband being buried. It's all just a very, very bad black mark for Boris Johnson, and you know, of course he'll do what he always does. He'll apologize and wave it away, but we'll see how many of these embarrassments he can continue to take in his stride, and I suspect that he's going to have a very rough time over the next few months.
Well, it's always great to speak to you, David. I'm sorry we missed last week, but we'll be back with you next week in this incredible wild world of media coverage of very strange media events.
Well, we'll be very regular and straightforward with it.
All right, David. Have a great weekend.
Bye-bye now.
David Taraschuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. And, of course, David does have his own website, themediabeat.us. And a reminder, he is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief.